Start, shall I?
Yes.
If you must.
Introduce this piece of shit.
Oh my god. The town that shredded sundown.
Rob.
Welcome back to the Cinemortuary Podcast. Our fortnightly look at usually, but not exclusively, terrible horror sequels and remakes.
Mm.
This week I'm in the chair for episode 26.
Mm. Going to talk about Alien 3 again, aren't we, Rob?
Going to talk about Alien 3 again, mate, yeah. Go.
How are we feeling?
Eat the sandwich.
Eat the sandwich.
Eat fine. It.
I'm waiting until I can say hello, then I'm going to eat the sandwich.
So, joined by Dave Walker, as always. Dave, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Very well. All the better for seeing you and your implausibly large sandwich that you're about to ingest.
Just getting there.
Good work. And Chris Wilson to my left, how are you?
That is a rather large Scooby snack.
Ah.
Flavour clip. Or don't.
Fuck off.
Oh, mate.
Oh, dissension in the ranks.
So, yeah, I'm in the chair this week.
And what are you reviewing this time, Robert?
I've decided to go for a what is technically known, according to Wikipedia, the source of all information, as a meta-sequel.
Yes, eating the sandwich.
Yep. Bite one. How is it? Meta-sequel to The Town That Dreaded Sundown. Now, usually, we have a bit of a preamble prior to recording, a bit of a chit-chat about the films and what we think, roughly. I've heard nothing from either of you on this one.
That's because we're busy watching backyard rescue videos.
Which, yeah, which was a good use of time, to be fair. So I'm quite intrigued as to, not that I'm not always, but I'm very intrigued to get your opinions this time around, as I have absolutely no idea what either of you are going to say. Now, I did say that the requirement of this episode was that we had to watch both the original and the meta sequel.
Yes, you did, didn't you, mate?
Yeah. Did we do that, lads? Fuck! No, I did. No. Very good. So I think, I guess first, I'm going to just throw a little context on both the original and the sort of sequel.
Yeah, yeah.
So, The Town That Dreaded Sundown was released in 1974. It was loosely based on real events. In a town called Texarkana, which is a real place.
It doesn't sound real, but yes.
It is real, and it is literally on the Texas and Arkansas border. That is true.
Such an American thing,
and
isn't it?
It's all true. There are two Texarkanas. There's Texas Texarkana, and there's the other one on the other side.
It's just very confusing.
Very confusing, yeah.
Everything was more simple when the natives were in charge, I feel.
Yeah.
So does that mean those old petrol stations, Texaco, were like on the Texas-Mexico border?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, now you've said that, it's probably true, isn't it?
Probably is true. We'll look into that later.
Get
in touch. Tweet us. At Cinemortuary.
Please do. Let us know. Petrol enthusiasts. So, yeah, this is based on true events-ish. It is true that there was a serial killer at large in this town in the late 40s, early 50s. It's also true that that person was never caught.
Did he wear a bag on his head?
That bit, I think, is slightly exaggerated, but the accounts state that they did have their face covered. Whether it was by a bag, you know, it's kind of open to question. There was a super duper investigator sent in to investigate the case, who was known as a little bit of a loose cannon. That is also true. There was a chap who had, who became a prime suspect many years after he died, and still to this day remains the only suspect in the murders.
Did he get arrested or did he just die?
No, he died a free man.
Okay.
So that is the context to both of the films, I guess, really. So maybe first might be a good idea to have a bit of bants about the original. It's a bit of a weird one because it's kind of shot partly as if it's a documentary.
Yeah, and then they sort of forget about it towards the end.
And just got off on a mad one. It's not a particularly. It's not considered a classic in any way, shape, or form. It's a bit of a forgotten film. It's not terrible, but it's not. You know, what did you think, Wilson, of the original?
Yeah, it's pretty much a C minus sort of film.
Yeah,
you know, it's
completely. Yeah,
it's just there, and I mean, I sort of like because. I assume it's like one of the more like original slasher films, you know, because obviously this predates like so Halloween, so
it does, and it also precurses Black Christmas, which is a film that's like often considered to be a precursor to Halloween. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, so it was quite neat, like sort of seeing like a bit more of the origin of that like type of genre, but it wasn't really doing much. To be fair, I mean, it is quite a low-budget film anyway, but the fact that we've tried based on true events where, like, nothing happened, like, there were, like, what, three murders, and then the guy whisked away, never to be heard from, you know, it didn't lend itself as great source material to begin with.
No.
And I think the film, after a while, the original film, that is, just sort of falls apart a bit and just starts meandering, because... Like for real case, it had nowhere to go.
Yeah, for sure.
I like the fact it it introduced itself that it was based on true events, because I suppose that was quite fresh at the time.
Yeah, before you know, in order to get nominated for an Academy Award, you had to say, "Oh, based on true events."
Yeah,
honest.
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure any time a film now says based on true events in its trailer or whatever, somewhere in the world, my father says, "Oh yeah, really? Fucking hell! All right then, which ones? Yeah,
maybe three events it's based on."
Yeah. Yeah, if you're in a cinema with him and that pops up in a trailer, it's pretty. It's funny and it's embarrassing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so
this is fresh, and I quite like. I do like the establishing maybe 10 minutes of it.
Yeah.
With the voiceover, it's one of those things where, you know, when you're watching a film and you feel like the voiceover's been added just for the especially thick cunts in the audience, like in Dark City,
where
it just tells you everything straight away.
Yeah.
World War II had ended only 8 months earlier, and the town of Texarkana, population 40,000, which straddles the Texas-Arkansas border, was regearing for peace after 4 years of rationing, war bonds, and shortages. Although a trickle was still arriving, most of the boys were back home and out of uniform. Many were enrolling in college or starting up businesses with the help of the GI Bill of Rights. Some people still had doubts about President Truman and were worried over the growing tension with Russia. The wave of strikes sweeping the country were being felt by many of the Texarkana businesses.
I kind of tried to tune it out and just watched it as it was.
Yeah.
And you see people pulling up in nice cars for, like, their school prom or whatever.
Blah, blah, blah. It is the school prom. People are unaware of the mass demo they're hiding in the woods.
And you're like, well, I can fucking... It's to call the town at Dreaded Sundown, and there's people at a prom. I can see this.
Yeah.
And straight from the start... Right. Straight... What?
My inner monologue at the time was, you're right, it is.
I can fucking see that. Cheers. It's just... Like you say, it is before Black Christmas and Halloween.
Yeah.
And therefore, the craft of the late 70s sort of slasher horror stuff hadn't come into its own. Like I said before, the 70s is almost like this no man's land of horror. Yeah. Everyone's trying all sorts of different shit to see what sticks.
Yeah.
And here you can really see that nothing's been established. Yeah. There's nothing to really lock onto your viewership.
Yeah.
The tone's all over the place. And like I mentioned to you, everything I don't like about Last House on the Left, with the fucking comedy cops and shit, with the bumbling, farty British Bake Off music underneath, it's here. And there's a half hour stretch in the middle of the film.
You can just do your ironing in that half hour.
I fucked off and did something else, and then came back for the last 20 minutes. And I hadn't missed anything.
No.
I was still listening to it over there, but like...
Yeah.
It's... I don't know what I expected from it.
No.
And I don't really know what I got out of it.
No. But when he came to watch when he came to watch the film we're reviewing properly, it is quite important, isn't it, to know
it is very important context. Yes. And it's hard to say whether I enjoyed the meta sequel more because I'd seen the original just before it.
I don't know. I was going to ask, do you think it would have made a difference? I mean, in hindsight, we should have had one of us not bother with the original just to see if we got it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah. What's done in done? Well, do you reckon, do you need to see both films in order to get the context of the remake?
I think the sequel would be more throwaway without the original source material because essentially they replace... The original is based on true events, whereas the meta sequel is essentially based on the true events of the first film sort of thing. So you kind of need the first film to contextualise it. And I enjoyed it more because I understood the references and callbacks.
The first time I watched the 2015 one, I hadn't seen the original.
Okay.
And this was the second time I watched it for this. My enjoyment of it was improved by watching the original.
Mm-hmm. Right, okay.
My context of it was improved by watching the original. Mm-hmm. Although, the first time I watched the 2015 one, I... not to get too deep into the discussion that will take place at the end of the podcast, but I did quite enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
But I did enjoy it more based on,
mm-hmm.
on watching the original.
Yeah. It was definitely worth doing both. Didn't enjoy the first one. But the second one, yes.
Yeah.
Very much, yeah, cool.
Cool.
Mm.
I suppose we should take a big old dive in then, really. Mm-hmm. I guess.
Probably. Did you say why you picked it, or was it just because it would be an interesting thing to do a metal sequel?
I picked it because, for a few reasons. I mean, the main reason was that... Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, when the first time I watched it, I thought it's one of them films where, actually, I had a really quite enjoyable time with it. Mm-hmm. Not quite to the level of the likes of My Bloody Valentine 3D, but I kind of put it in a similar sort of camp to that, in that it was unexpectedly quite good fun, I felt, the first time I watched it.
Visually, editing, presentation-wise, colour palette, these films are very similar,
yeah.
Which I very much liked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of.
The late noughties sort of high contrast, not Platinum Dune shit look,
yeah.
But sort of TV movie look. That was quite fashionable at the time.
Exactly, yeah. And another reason I picked it was because, obviously, Blumhouse are about to do a rebootquel of Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, having read the direction they're going in with the new Halloween film and what that's going to be about, this almost feels like a little bit of a dress rehearsal.
It's kind of a warm-up to that.
In a sense.
Yeah. Okay.
So I thought it'd be interesting to look back on it again and maybe get a steer of where that film might go as well within the oeuvre, if that's a word, of Blumhouse. That is my justification.
Like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, cool. Take us in then, Rob.
Yep.
Dive.
So cheeky preamble is we kick off in a drive-in cinema, which is showing the original Town That Dreaded Sundown.
That's so meta.
Yeah, on board immediately. Mm-hmm. I'm down with that sort of shit.
Love a drive-in as well.
Love a drive-in. Very meta. And it establishes a whole bunch of things that I quite like off the bat.
When is this film set, by the way?
Interesting question.
I had a hard time placing where the first film was set.
It says in the opening Chiron, you know, the following is set last year.
Yep.
Now, I think the idea is it's supposed to be 2014, then if this is released 2015, but everyone's dressed like it's the 70s. So.
And they're driving around in muscle cars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so there is... In the film, there's a couple of cards that come up, as in the original, where it shows time, date, and it's 2013,
that's
shown. I think that's a year... I think they were probably thinking, when they were in the edit, it probably was 2014.
Right.
And I guess that's where that came from. You're quite right to point out, both of you, the 70s kind of aesthetic.
Because the original film's made in the 70s, set in the 50s, is that right?
46.
46.
46, yeah.
And I found that quite confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this one is set 20 years after that first film came out.
So they're going for the same gap then, do you reckon?
They've kind of gone for the same gap, and they've played into it quite well, because it does basically string you along, because they're in a driving theatre, they're driving around in muscle cars and hot rods.
It's basically, I think the idea is that Texarkana is a little bit backwards.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of implied by some of that setup, and also a lot of the sort of stuff that gives you that 70s feeling is Well, it's down to two things. One is the costume design.
Yeah, yeah.
And two is the way that it's the post-production on it is had is quite a grainy 70s kind of feel.
Yeah, kind of washed out beigey sort of. Yeah, yeah. And I think they're having fun with it, to be honest, in some respect. Yeah, I think they've decided to do what the original did and just do some ambiguity to it. So, yeah, I like
that. It's almost like a little bit of a grindhouse vibe, and that the driving thing feeds into that as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, love a driving, love a sort of shit American backwater, and we're immediately sort of by the sort of weird sort of religious folks that are protesting.
I was going to say there's some religion shoehorned in here for you.
There's a little bit of religion shoehorned in there, which isn't great. Which isn't great, but it's it kind of establishes the sort of a lot of things about the alt-right, as we now call them, I guess, and the right wing of America that think all of life's problems are caused by horror films or
Marilyn Manson.
Marilyn Manson, yeah.
And it's quite cleverly done, because obviously in this town, once a year they get the film out and treat the film like it was made about the original murders, which I guess it was, and they watch it every year, because that sort of made the town in the same way that the Blair Witch films made the Blair Witch town.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you know, Wilson, when you killed that dude with the hands.
Yeah.
Hands. Why?
It kind of, it's something that is the character of the town. Yeah. And you get a feel like the conservative Christian aspect of that town aren't really down for it, sort of thing.
No, exactly.
Well, they just want something to be angry about, and they found it, so.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So we, yeah, we get a few things established. We get the, local god botherers giving a little bit of grief to a lad walking into the screening in an original talent dreaded sundown t-shirt, a lad that will reappear again later and
Preacher's quite an interesting character, and he'll come back as well.
Preacher's quite an interesting character. We get a couple of these little characters established fairly early.
It's almost done in a one-shot as well, I think.
It is, yeah. Like I was going to point out, it's actually a very nice shot to open on, because they go through, and I think we also establish our couple who are going to go on to Lover's Lane and, spoiler.
Yeah, it's not quite Spielberg, but everyone hit their mark there, didn't they?
It was nicely done. And we meet our leading girl, I guess you could.
A bit of chick.
In the car with her boyfriend, and they decide that she's not really that up for the film.
No.
So like go. Me. Yeah, exactly. So they'll do one to Lover's Lane.
Yeah,
like you would have done if you'd have had the choice, Dave.
I'd gone home and watched Alien 3, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So off they pop to Lover's Lane, and then we have quite quickly a classic horror trope. Go on, sorry, Wilson.
Classic horror trope where we talk about colleges. What college have you got in? Oh, I don't know. I might be going to California. I don't know yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, dicks out.
Fuck!
You know, let's rummage. Yeah,
exactly. Now, which brings me to the classic horror trope I was talking about. Teens getting it on in a car.
Are we going to have a horror movie cliche moment of the week coming up here?
I mean, it's a contender, isn't it?
You're going to keep your powder dry.
It's a contender.
Okay. Yeah.
It's a contender.
No, I was going to say, I think if your contender is people having a rummage in a car, I'm sure there's at least one more time where it's at least teased. But we'll come back to that later on as we start establishing different deaths in this film.
Yeah.
Because we get a bit repetitive, but we'll
it's much more eloquently handled than the one in the first film where the guy literally looks like he's lost his fucking contact lens in a footwell.
Yeah.
And he just sticks his head down there like that.
He's gonna have a look at it.
I'm just looking for it. And then Baghead turns up.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
This is much better.
Yeah, no, it's much more slickly done. Mm-hmm. It's got a little bit of Platinum Dunes vibe going on.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, so our mate Baghead tips up.
Yeah.
Is he officially called Baghead?
Yeah, I think he's got to be, hasn't he?
He has been, yeah. It's just a shame he didn't have a Tesco carrier bag around his head or something.
That would have been ideal.
You can suffocate, though, Wilson.
He's over 3 years old, he'll be fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, the main difference here when he turns up is this guy talks.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, take off your fucking pants to the guy.
So the first time I saw this, I thought, is he going to fucking bum him?
I thought he was going to do the same thing,
This is going to be unnecessarily brutal early doors.
Mm. Yeah. This is going to be a switcheroo. He's not after the women anymore, he's after the dudes.
But what I really liked about this little sequence is he forces her to turn around and not watch what he's doing. And the focus here isn't the violence. The focus is her reaction to it.
Mm.
And I think it's a really nicely done little scene. I mean, what did you think, Wilson?
Yeah, I thought it was done really well. And considering the revelations later on, it's quite a nice like little bait and switch as well, you know, from expectation. Because, you know, this guy's been brutally murdered. Or has he?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, but... because we don't see it, you know, it seems a lot more brutal as well.
Get out of the car.
Damn, Jamie, she's in the car.
Get out of the fucking car or I'll shoot her in the face. Do your mom and daddy know where you were tonight, boy?
The movie? Yes.
What about yours?
They're dead.
Take your pants off.
What?
Take off your fucking pants.
Corey, just do it.
Okay, all right. Come on, man.
Get down on the fucking ground.
Okay. All right, I am. I'm not gonna run anywhere. Now, please, can you just let her go?
No.
Please don't kill him.
You, turn around. Do not look back.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of bits in this film, and there's a reason why I brought up My Bloody Valentine sort of early on, where there's very direct comparisons to be made between the two films. But yeah, I think the opening's quite stylistic. It's quite nicely done. I like the way that they use the red of the taillights of the car quite effectively in this scene. And the score's pretty decent as well. It's kind of...
I can't say I remember it, but at the same time, I can't remember most horror scores.
Yeah.
And it just does its job very well.
Yeah.
I think it raised the tension. It was nasty where it needed to be. It definitely gripped me.
Yeah,
I certainly didn't go back and finish off sorting my sock drawer like I did with the first one.
No, exactly, so, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah,
it was quite riveting stuff.
And as
oi, Baghead!
his goal is to make people remember.
You
know,
yeah,
or as he says, like, okay, read my own writing now. This is for me. Make him remember.
Make Mary remember Mary, something like that.
Yeah,
Yeah.
You know why? Why he says that? You know, we don't know till later. But you know,
yeah.
So this is definitely a copycat case.
Yeah, I like the fact that you instantly get that without it expressly telling you. I don't think I think it's about halfway through they say the word copycat.
Yeah.
But you know it's not because he's so very different.
Yeah, and you know, I think we also briefly mentioned is it the same guy? It's like, well, no, of course it's not, because it's not fucking 1947, is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, there's an element of realism in there as well. That's quite.
Yeah.
Anyway, Jamie manages to escape, and she runs through the woods, and she reappears, you know, having to drag her body, you know, at this point she's totally exhausted.
Yeah.
Right beneath the screen where they're showing the ending of the Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah. Beautiful.
It is nicely done, to be fair.
It's like this...
that little pullback in it where you realise where she is.
Yeah.
The first time I watched this, I thought it was going to be proper shit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because I'd not seen the original, as I say, at the time, and it kind of just looked like another fairly shit sort of slasher film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This opening sort of 10-15 minutes, I was like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, this is clearly people behind the camera that have thought about it. Mm-hmm. And I did, as I often like to, I did a little cheeky bit of research.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the two producers on this and the director, both heavily, heavily involved in the TV series American Horror Story.
Which you've seen.
But the director directed a lot of the better episodes of it.
Okay.
And the producer was the one that's very creatively involved in it. So it's very much a very similar creative team to that.
Yes, like I said, it does have that sort of slick modern TV look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
and it gets stuff done quick. and efficient. Yeah, no, exactly. You can definitely tell there's experience behind the camera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So from there, we kind of like hurries the process along quite a bit again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't really fuck about with a lot of like our heroine in hospital recovery and blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. It kind of like jumps a little bit.
Yeah.
And gives us where she sort of starts to throw herself into investigating the film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the sort of original stories around that.
Mm.
I was particularly keen to get you guys' thoughts on the way that they do this, because it is a little bit jarring in that it kind of like shit happens and then they almost cut out that little bit that you normally see in horror films afterwards of her like recovering and shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think within 5 minutes she's on the case.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you feel about that?
I was fine with it because, you need to move the story along, mm-hmm. and no, her job in this is to basically be quite fearless when it comes mm-hmm. to finding out what the hell is going on. And I think it would be a bit jarring if, after we see her in the hospital bed and she's told by the police not to really say anything, not to cause mm-hmm. a panic, if she then like is walking around like in a half-shocked state, you know,
mm-hmm.
in some sort of moral quandary or anything like that, you know, it just gets straight on with it and they quite like it.
Yeah.
And it really helps the character as well that, you know, we know instantly she's got that driving determination.
Yeah, no, yeah, definitely. And I think it one of the great strengths of this film, and films sort of like it, and some of the films that we've seen in this podcast that we've enjoyed, is there's no wasted motion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not faffing about with unnecessary baggage. It is very much point A, point B.
Yeah.
You know, and that's quite, it's just quite an enjoyable viewing experience because you can just sort of switch off and enjoy it, really.
Yeah, yeah. Pretty much. I do appreciate efficient filmmaking.
Yeah.
One of the only things I really hate when I'm watching a film is if it just grinds to a real slow pace.
Yeah.
For no reason other than to indulge itself. And this is not interested in that at all.
No.
No.
It's not Dracula, is it?
Not really, no. No.
Your favourite film ever, Dave.
Absolutely, yeah. And in some respects, she doesn't really have much of a character beyond moving everything forward.
Yeah.
Which is fine.
Mm.
Yeah.
She doesn't need to be the most interesting character. Your most interesting character is Baghead.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Yeah. As we'll find out as we move on. But yeah, I really like the pacing early on especially.
Yeah, and I think what they've been quite careful to do, and what they are quite careful to do throughout the film, mm-hmm. is they're quite careful to avoid it being like another, like, Diet Michael Myers. They focus much more on the whodunit aspect.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, it's a bit more like Agatha Christie than
Halloween. Yeah, it does. That's a very good point about it not being just Michael Myers, because, you know, there's such an obvious comparison there. Just even the way they look and how imposing they look, you know.
Yeah.
But they sort of manage to avoid the comparison.
Yeah, well, they actively seek to shut it down later on in the film when we'll get to the bit where the investigator guy with the hat comes in.
Yeah.
But there's a line in the film where he specifically says, you know, we're not hunting some kind of boogeyman, we're hunting a flesh and blood man.
Yeah,
you know, and they do hammer home that point throughout it, which I think is quite refreshing.
It's an angry dude with a gun that just happens to have a bag on his head sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's exactly. kind of it. I don't exactly, like that. Yeah. Yeah.
So then we get the usual couple of standard issue slasher movie scenes. We get our heroine going back home to find there's a police car guarding outside. Classic slasher film material.
Yeah.
Wonder if they're one of two things is going to happen to them, lads. They're either going to get killed or they're going to be completely ineffectual to the rest of the film.
Absolutely.
Mm. They would do the classic heroine going into therapy to deal with the shit that's happened to mm-hmm. her, but it's all done quite sort of matter of fact.
Yeah.
And quite offhand.
Mm-hmm. Don't drugs?
No.
No.
Moving on. Exactly. On we go. You know, Dream Warriors, this is not.
Yeah, kind of how the system actually is.
Yeah.
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 Just shoot them through the system and get the fuck out. Yeah, yeah.
And then before we know it, we're on to an extremely athletic shagging scene.
Yes, mate.
Yeah. Quite Olympian in of efforts, yeah.
Rummaging correspondent, would you like to take this one?
Gold medal?
Oh yeah, that's right. It was a cracking mummage. It was a cracking mummage.
Yeah,
top end for both competitors.
It's nice that before they get to this rummage scene, we're introduced to a woman that is obviously very athletic, and a gentleman that has just come back from a tour in the military.
Yes,
who is in cracking shape and probably a real hard fucker.
Yeah,
because he's survived wherever he's been. So you know that these two characters are pretty no nonsense.
Yeah. And then for a moment, I thought I'd accidentally turned on Pornhub.com. It was a cracking rummage. But it turns out it's part of a film. Rummaging away in a quite miserable-looking motel.
Yeah.
And as he leaves to go do something, I don't know, get ice for the champagne
bucket. It's always getting ice.
Yeah, it's always that.
I'm just going to go get ice. I'm going to go say hi to Mrs. Betts on the way.
I'll be right back.
I just need to stick my dick in some ice just to cool it off a bit. So, she produces an engagement ring, because I guess that's the next step after a cracking rummage.
I mean, but, you should be producing the engagement ring, I think.
Yeah. Then here comes old Baghead again.
Killer of the week.
Yeah, she tries to escape. She jumps off, I think it's like the second floor.
Can I just rewind you there?
Let's talk about this killer of the week.
There's just one little bit that fucking, like, is prime cinematography material.
Yes, mate.
He's outside the window, and he fucking breaks the window by lobbing her boyfriend's severed head through it.
He smashes it through a first time, and then...
Absolutely unreal stuff.
That is kill of the week for me. You see it in CCTV footage later, and they're all watching it in the police station, and he just comes up the stairs with his boy's head, and then you see him on a wire just fucking pummeling the window with
it. Like, absolutely brilliant. And this scene is one of a couple that directly reminded me of My Bloody Valentine.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. You got your shagging and then an immediate post kill.
Yeah. Outside of my hotel, she jumps up and, you know, with a bone sticking out her leg. She tries to run along, but, you know, she gets stabbed.
She does, yeah.
Mr. Stabby.
When she's trying to get her foot on the pedal, and you can hear the bone squelching about, and just her legs just flapping around on the pedal limp. It's one of those moments in a horror film where my testicles actually start to ache.
Yeah.
It's like a dull ache where you're just like, oh, God, no, fuck. Just kill her, please.
We've got in this bit where he tags her out in the car, we have got our second consecutive episode where the blood work looks like someone's exploded. Because she's like, literally, she's like, back of that car.
She's just she's a nurse, you see. She's smuggling bags of plasma in her jacket.
Yeah, that'll be it, yeah. That'll be it. Good God in heaven. So then, obviously, quite quickly after this, word spreads of the murderization, doesn't it?
Yep.
Which leads to one of my favourite little montage-y bits of the film, which is where they intercut the 2015 version of everyone battening down the hatches with the 40s version of people battening down the hatches.
Mm.
That was fucking really nicely done.
It was, yeah. I agree with that one. Yeah, and then in the next scene, Jamie, she gets a phone call later at night from her dead boyfriend. Hooray! It's Baghead, obviously, who threatens to keep... Yeah.
Spoilers.
To keep doing what he's doing until they all remember.
Yeah.
And then, straight from that, we go to a town forum with an update where we get a bit more of the old religion and horror and...
Some of that old-time religion, will he?
Yeah.
Shoehorned in.
Grumpy.
Yeah. That's just fucking nonsense, isn't it? I should have bored of it very easily.
Yeah.
And then not long after that, we get the standard issue super cop sent from the big city.
Who? You mean from Texas?
From Texas, yeah. From somewhere else in Texas. But we can assume he's come from somewhere, you know, proper.
Yeah.
He looks pretty LL Cool J, mate.
He's come from Houston, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so we've got the clash of the Texas and Arkansas police, like a great big cock-waving exercise.
Which I thought was hilarious and quite nicely played as
it
well.
It was, yeah. Yeah, especially later on, like the way they play it, where like the Arkansas police like just couldn't give a fuck.
Where
Texas ones actually really, you know, want to get the job done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. And then... well, there's a couple of things that happened here that made me laugh a little bit in the next couple of scenes. So, like, the first one was the killer sending an email.
Yeah.
Which just immediately, like, gave me visions of old Baghead, like, hunched over his MacBook.
Or an internet cafe or something. Yeah. Just trying to find Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Just, like, deleting his sent. Nah, it's not what I want to say.
And at the end it says, cheers, sent from my iPhone.
Yeah. Oh, my favourite type one, and I get emails sometimes like this at work. You can set your like if you're emailing from your phone, you can you can change it at the bottom to like. Someone sent me one the other week that said, "Apologies for any typos or brevity. Sent in haste." It just reminded me of this scene. For Just imagine like a couple of typos and a little apology at the end.
I suddenly got the image of like Baghead, you know, his email signature is please consider the environment before you print off this email.
Yeah.
Printer friendly version, yeah.
Try to respond to him and just get out of office.
Yeah. If you urgently need to contact me, then call my secretary on.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So that was quite odd. And then we obviously the killing of our heroine's boyfriend was we're probably a couple of weeks down the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say so. Mm-hmm.
And she's already seems to have attracted another man.
This absolute fucking block drain of a human being. Fuck me.
It's a bit of a drip, isn't he?
Tedious little Smeagol-like creature, isn't he?
Yeah. He plays Magic the Gathering. That's what he does.
Oh, he definitely does, yeah, yeah. 100%. Not professionally, by himself.
No, yeah, just on his own, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. He's purely in this film to kind of pull slightly repulsed or offended faces when anyone insults the original killer, so you think, oh, it's him.
Yeah, exactly.
It's him.
He's too nice, it must be
him. Reacted funny. And he, because of that, you'll be watching scenes and he'll be just to the left of frame.
Yeah.
And he'll be horrendously overreacting to what people say.
Yeah.
I think the killer was an idiot and he'll sit there going, like he's got Tourette's or something.
I'll teach you. You're on the list.
My favourite thing about this guy is I think he's like a. He's trying to get a bit of a rummage with Jamie because
it was a cracking rummage.
Well, obviously,
because there was $12 worth of Xeroxing done, but he's giving it all to her for free.
I know, mate. Those credits ain't cheap.
He's well fucking in there, lads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it is pointed out pretty early doors that he does have psychological issues as well.
Yes.
A photocopier killed his mum and dad.
Yeah.
What's playing Magic?
Yeah. So it's just like... I mean, he's pretty fucking rubbish, isn't he, this lad? You know?
He's a drip, mate. He's a leaky faucet.
He is. But he's like, he's just such a stock slasher film character as well. I kind of love it.
He's sadly necessary sort of thing.
Exactly. He's just there. He's wallpaper.
Yeah.
So, next thing we find out that Jamie has been accepted into her Californian college, as mentioned before, but she's, she's hiding that fact because, you know, she sort of doesn't want to move on until she knows what's happened.
Also, she doesn't want to leave Veronica Cartwright behind in town by herself.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that too.
Great to be seeing Veronica Cartwright, though.
Absolutely, yeah.
She is a haunting-looking woman, though.
I didn't think it was her at first because she's looked like that for 25 years.
Yeah.
And I thought, that can't be her. She looked like that when she was in X-Files in, like, 93.
Bloody is her though, isn't it, Dave? Yeah.
I think she looks younger, in fact, now.
Yeah, a bit of a spot of work done.
Oh, shit.
Then Jamie goes to the police station to present what she's found so far.
Mm-hmm.
One of the main things is that the guy who they thought could have done it, like the only real suspect, Benjamin Sewell, who died like the year before, how he used to have like a single visitor come like see him, you know, like probably described as like a young man. What if it's his son? Is he coming for revenge?
Yeah.
But it turns out that guy died 2 years ago.
Yep.
Yeah.
So
that's that fucked.
Bit of a brick wall there. Uh-huh. So the whole SEAL lead is dead. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's nothing to do with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So from there, we move on. I believe there's a service planned for the victims thus far.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Which. It's quite nicely shot. It's kind of, I mean, look, it's well worn. We're well and truly in cliche territory here, 100%. Yeah. Some might say it is a little bit contrived, this.
Sorry, listeners.
Sorry.
That makes my testicles ache when you say that.
Yeah, but sorry.
It must be said, the use of candles here is a bit better than Alien 3.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sort of makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah.
I really, I like the way that. It's like the two main characters don't realise they've walked into this memorial service.
Yeah.
Because it kind of just, they're just kind of walking and talking, and all of a sudden you see these out-of-focus candles in the background,
yeah.
And they realise where they are. Yeah. And obviously not everyone likes her, because obviously in her statement she said she ran away and left her boyfriend to get stabbed.
Yeah, and that was evidenced at the wake as well, which we did sort of skip over, where the mother basically...
Fucking fuming. And when she kind of goes to this memorial, it's kind of, they've walked into it by accident almost, and then they become silent, and then everyone's sort of looking at them, and then they turn back to what they were doing. It's a real nice sort of outside of feel.
Yeah, it's got a really nice, it almost feels like a dance scene in a way, like it's got a really weird sort of flow to it.
Yeah.
And then our, Baghead tips up.
Well, he does, mate,
Hey, Baghead tips up.
I really like this because you sort of don't expect in that moment for him to actually just show up in full view of fucking everyone and have a go.
Yeah.
I got his ass.
No. No, Nick, wait, I need to know.
Baghead gets shot.
Yeah, because at least we forget we've got the military guy. His friends are going to be there.
Of course they are, with their guns.
And we're carrying guns.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fucking Baghead, you idiot.
So now, this is a really interesting scene, this, because I did a bit of thinking about this. Because it's obviously the mask's taken off and it's out. It's Matey Boy from the driving at the start.
Yeah. And, that kid that listens to Limp Bizkit still.
Yeah, and the kid looked quite miserable.
Well, I did it. Fucking hell. Oh dear.
Did it for the nookie, didn't you, Willie?
I did. The nookie. Stick it up you.
Yeah!
Stick it up you.
Yeah! The kid looked quite miserable at the start, and I think there's a bit of something going on here story-wise.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically a suicide by gun situation, isn't it?
Because
from a logical perspective, you know, that he knows what's going to happen to him there.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just quite an interesting little sequence, because I feel like he wasn't really fleshed out as a character.
No, he doesn't say anything, I don't think.
No,
he doesn't.
Not at all.
No. And I would ordinarily criticise that, but I think it kind of works.
It's nice sort of storytelling. I mean, I think we've gone about this before, how you get sick of films where they have to make things really obvious and build it up.
Yeah.
Just, you know, it's whole screenwriting logic. You've got to really hammer it in. Whereas I really like it when something like really subtle happens where I must admit I didn't even twig on that he was there in the opening sequence. You know, I just thought it was a copycat of a copycat.
So I
do like that sort of thing.
It's good that the film didn't have to stop to say who he was. You just know that he's not a particularly happy man that has no respect for authority figures. Done. Yeah. That was done in that one shot at the start.
Yeah.
Easy peasy.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Mm. So, I thought it was quite nice.
I think what I really liked afterwards was the following scene at the restaurant where they get the news filters through that they've shot the killer, you know, and he's dead.
Yeah, yeah.
So they decide to change the somber music for something a bit more exciting so they can dance.
Yeah, yeah.
And such, which I really like. It's quite fanatical of them, you know. It's
There's something a little bit... It's almost a bit Stepford Wivesy, this.
It is, yeah.
And it's a little, like, it's kind of like that well-worn thing of, like, people in authority or the wealthy in a place being almost a little bit cultish and a little bit weird.
I got that vibe. This follows on nicely from the memorial sequence.
Yeah.
Where there's a thing where they all turn around and then slowly turn back. It's almost got that Village of the Damned...
It's a bit like It as well, with the people.
A bit like It.
Yeah.
And Body Snatchers, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it's how they've almost adjusted to this thing that's going on in their town. They don't really dread sundown anymore. They've kind of just learnt to deal with it.
Yeah, they've become detached from it.
And it's like, oh, someone's been shot dead. Let's have some big band brass music on.
Yeah.
I also quite like it, another sort of detail, but why weren't they at the vigil themselves? It's like the town's already like sort of divided up, you know.
Yeah, there's only like maybe 24 people at this vigil.
Yeah.
It's weird, yeah.
Yeah, but it's sort of like you get a feeling because like the preacher guy and such were at the restaurant instead.
Yeah.
You know, like the older generation were probably thinking that, you know, these guys who have been killed by Bago probably deserved it, you know.
Yes, it was a couple having sex and it was a young man in a car trying to come onto a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it.
And then in their midst, the people on stage performing happen to be gay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all quite clever, to be honest.
It is, yeah.
We might be giving them the benefit of the doubt, but it's quite, I think it's quite nice.
Yeah, no, it's quite subversive, isn't it, in parts. And if you watch American Horror Story, I don't know if either of you have ever watched much of it.
No.
No, it's really, like, the first sort of three or four series are fucking really good.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, the premise of it is that it's largely the same cast every season.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different stories, and they all play different characters.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. And they all have different settings. So the first series is called Murder House, and it's about this house that has a history of bad shit happening in it, basically. And the second one is in an asylum. I think, is it the third one that's in the asylum? One's in an asylum, one's like a freak show one, which is really interesting. Yeah, it's a bit like the film Freaks.
Mm-hmm.
And as they sort of... I think it's the third or fourth series, the Freak Show one anyway, they start to sort of suggest, and there's a Coven one as well, which is in, but they start to suggest that all of these different stories and characters played by the same actors are somehow interlinked.
Interesting.
It's quite interesting. It's still going. It's very... sort of clever in that way, and there's kind of more, it feels like there's a little bit more going on under the surface.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, again, sort of comparing it to, well, yes, and comparing it and not comparing it to My Bloody Valentine, in that if you compare a film like this, again, to, and we will cover it someday, and I know I keep going on about it, but like the fucking Friday the 13th remake again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's just nothing happening in that film, is there? It's just
not at all. It's just nuts and bolts and planks of wood in it without any sort of,
Exactly. So we have our gay couple who have a mooch off to, like, it's like an old sign graveyard, isn't it, basically?
Yeah. And I love how they pull up in front of a billboard of the preacher guy.
That
was a really nice detail.
It's good fun.
And then...
Well, they have a rummage, don't they, Willie?
They do have a rummage.
Well, they don't. That's the thing. Yeah,
their attempted rummage is broken off.
No, what I really love about this is that they just get into a really awkward conversation. Well, who goes first? Like, what we're supposed to do? What's
you
going on?
I don't know. Do you? Why do I have to go first?
There is an honesty about it.
It is, yeah. And I just really like that, you know. Yes.
So. How does this work?
I don't know. I thought maybe you could, you know.
What?
You know. Go down there. And suck it.
Suck it.
I don't know, maybe a little.
What, is it hard?
Yeah. You some chairs?
Yeah.
You first, and then I'll do you.
Maybe we could...
Just nicely done.
Yeah.
And they are interrupted as Baghead reappears again.
Hello!
Yeah, and this time... after sort of tagging off one guy,
yep.
Well, Bill is like unconscious elsewhere,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Blooded up. It's time to recreate the trumpet scene.
Yes.
Isn't it?
Which is far more horrible now.
Yeah. Before we get into this too much, I just want to say, although it is quite cliche,
yeah.
I fucking love locations like this in horror films.
So much to look at, so much to light.
Yeah, and just, it's really surreal as well.
Yeah, the fact that there's elevations and stuff.
Yeah.
And
but yeah, the...
Yeah.
Yeah, the trumpeting.
The continued gay subtext that is also applied here.
Yeah.
Is, I think it's what makes it more unpleasant.
Yeah.
Is the fact that he's basically just taking this dude from behind.
Yeah, he is, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And it's more effective than in the previous film.
Yeah.
Mm. In the previous film, it's just a bit weird. Like,
yeah.
Yeah,
just like, this is stupid.
There has to be a trumpet there, and it's a bit... bizarre. Whereas,
but here, there's brass instruments lying around because they play brass.
Yeah.
And it's got a much nastier edge to it. And because you quite like these two characters, they're quite funny.
Yeah.
And they're quite adorable in a way. Yeah. Not to be condescending, but they are quite adorable.
Well, I think because of what you just said in the scene previously, there's a
naivety to it. And they haven't really done anything wrong.
No. Yeah. And I think this time around as well, like the actual number of times you get stabbed... must be at least triple of what the girl got in the original as well.
Yeah, he just keeps going until he's mush, doesn't he?
Yeah, and obviously this time he like gets siblings, stab wounds and everything. It's
what's happening to the young fella on the lower level? Has he got shot?
Well, no, this is what happens. He basically gets blooded up, then is like told to run, and he is shot just before the trumpet thing starts.
Yeah, so the other lad's made to watch first,
that's it.
Isn't
basically.
It's quite gruesome, this. It's quite brutal if you break it down.
Yeah. It's just, he's a very angry killer, which is quite energising and refreshing to watch, to be honest.
And he got a good sound out of the trumpet, though.
He did, actually,
The other guy was just like, this one is full on.
Yeah, yeah, Wagner would be proud, mate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Moving on. Willie.
So, at this point, do you think the Lurpak man's done it?
Could be.
Stop bassooning around and get on, please.
Oh,
that's a wind instrument, but I will let you off. Yeah. Just a clarinet. We are not in any...
Jesus. I'm getting a bit brassed off with all these
points.
That pun flew over my head.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, yeah.
You're just blowing your own trumpet now.
Read it in, mate.
Boo.
God. Anyway.
Saxophone.
Next, we have... a bit of a weird and awkward conversation between our heroine and the new sort of, is he a psycho or not guy? And he basically makes a bit of a pass at her,
mm-hmm.
and she turfs him out.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely on his arse, isn't he?
Yeah.
this is a really, well, not an awkward scene. It's actually a really good scene, but I love how she gives a story of how her parents died when they were younger, which is to quickly go through. She was at a sleepover at a friend's house, and their older brother dressed up as Baghead, the original one, and scared her so much that her parents had to come and collect her.
Yeah.
And on the resulting car drive home, they crashed and they died. So that's why she's already had it in for Baghead before, the new one.
Yep.
And then... the Nick or whatever he's called goes, Ooh, perfect opportunity.
Rubbish! Here I come.
Yeah, and then, and yeah, so...
The image has failed.
An absolute fail from him.
It's an immediate, no, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
Get the
yeah.
fuck out my face.
Well, yeah, like, what did you expect to happen? What
in friend zone, motherfucker.
Do you think she's turned on by her parents dying and she was like right there, watched it happen? Fucking hell.
Yeah.
What an idiot.
Very strange, man. Very strange.
He did it.
Yeah.
Chloe did it.
He did it. Nick Herring did it.
And then, sort of sometime after this, I think we start to come on to the questioning of the Reverend when it's revealed that the Reverend sent the email.
Motherfucker.
That's he it. Did, yeah.
Now, it was sent from his iPhone, though.
When they said, when this little bit of knowledge is revealed, immediately I was like, this fucking could be, like, a Murder on the Orient Express / Hot Fuzz scenario, where it's like... For the greater good. For yeah, and it's all good. Them knobheads from earlier on. And I started getting a bit excited about the prospect.
Mm-hmm.
But sadly not. Sadly not. It's kind of shut down quite quickly, isn't it? And there's kind of excuses made and he has alibis and things like that.
Yeah. Well, his justification is that since everyone's been in fear, church attendances have been way up.
Yeah. Which I think is a nice little comment on organised religion.
It is,
as well.
Yeah. Like they literally care more about church attendances than, you know, kids not being dead, you know.
By sending this email, I'm saving people.
I didn't send this email. Well, the FBI traced it back to you, Joe, so... Why'd you send it to the girl to muddy up the waters? I don't know what to tell you.
Here's what I think. I don't think you killed anybody, but I do believe you sent this message. See, I hear you at night, preaching. Nothing much for me to do in my hotel room, so I wonder, are you doing this for publicity or...
He chose that girl to be his herald, his messenger. He is doing the Lord's work.
He's killing our kids, Joe.
My church is more full than it has been in years. People are coming to me asking for redemption, for salvation. They're scared, Hank. They want to walk on the righteous path again. I want to call the mayor. And then I want to call my lawyer.
Yeah.
Right.
Just fuck off to Reddit, will you?
Yeah, exactly. You might have actually got two people killed, mate, with your fucking, like, distracting bullshit.
So, moving on from there, Nick reappears and apologises for his rummage attempt. And the next idea they have is to go talk to the director's son, because he's still... Is it his son?
Yes, it's his son.
Yeah,
hanging around in the town.
Yeah, because he still lives in the town.
Yeah.
And he gives her, like, a necklace, doesn't he, for Christmas as an apology for the attempted rummage. It's never really picked up on again, but it's just a bit weird.
Yeah.
Again, you apologise for being weird by being weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder if she's checked the engraving on the other side of the necklace. It's probably just like a cock and balls.
Probably is, yeah.
IR Baghead.
Lol. So, they go see the son of the director of the original film who lives on the boat.
In between, we get another death by sex part 3.
Oh, yeah.
Or 4 at this point. Because it's Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
One of the policemen goes to the local CD bar.
Oh yeah, this is good. This.
Yeah. You know, and he's been working all that.
Because that guy all the way through has been kind of shutting people down in interviews and stuff.
Yeah.
And he's constantly sort of been on everyone's case.
Yeah.
So he is actually a suspect at this point from a viewership perspective.
Yeah.
You kind of think, oh, maybe he's...
When he gets shot in the head while getting head, doesn't he, basically?
Yes, mate, and it's nasty. You see that bullet go in.
You do see that bullet go in. And the bit I love about it, it's like she's obviously doing a business. And then she's like, what the fuck? What's wrong with you? And he's like, oh, yeah, you're dead as fuck, shit. And then there's a really, really nicely shot sequence in the maze field. Shot from above.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's fantastic, so... It's like a bit of a longish, like sort of cornfield. So she's out.
It's like it's waist high corn, which makes it even more tense because she has to crouch down the whole time, and he's looking at over everything.
Yeah, just a crawl. And if you're looking from above, like as we see from camera angle, it's pretty obvious where she is. But obviously, he has no idea.
Yeah.
And the only thing that gives the game away is she bumps into a scarecrow and she screams.
Yeah.
Idiot.
The scarecrow got a baghead as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the scarecrow did it.
Maybe. Maybe. Yeah, and so then, is it the next day then the bodies are discovered?
Yeah, but well, yep. she's replaced the scarecrow,
yeah.
basically.
Mm. Yeah, there's another really nicely done bit of it's deliberately designed to match the house where there's a similar sort of scene in the original
mm-hmm.
where someone gets shot through a window.
Mm.
And again, it's intercut between our footage we're seeing now and the old footage.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really digging that shit. I'm really like.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
Because it's quite rare. Obviously, you see flashback sequences and stuff overlaid quite normally, usually flipping newspaper reels and shit.
Yeah.
But in this, they've got a whole other film to pull footage from, and that's why these scenes are so strong for me.
Yeah.
It's because they've got subtext to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, for sure. For sure. So where do we wash off to then?
To the film director's son's house.
Oh, the boat, yeah.
Yeah.
So this is this
boat
guy.
In the field.
Yeah. This guy is one of the leads in American Horror Story.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's one of the main characters in American Horror Story. And he always plays a bit of a creepy weird fucker.
Basically. He's been in the background being a creepy weird fucker through most of this film.
Yeah.
So far.
Yeah,
probably should have mentioned that. But you get the idea that he's a suspect as well near the start.
Oh, for sure, yeah, for sure. And he doesn't really do himself many favours here.
No.
He comes off as a bit of a weird fanboy of his dad's work.
Yeah.
And this might be me overthinking it, but it's almost drawn as a Norman Bates character, but his obsessions with his dad and not his mother.
A bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a bit of a rip-off of Norman Bates, isn't he, in a
sense? Kind of like a nervous fool sort of thing.
Yeah.
Just sort of bumbling around his house.
Yeah.
Yeah, same sort of style.
Yeah, but he does give off that vibe of you're definitely a candidate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But too much of a candidate, to
be honest. Because he starts going on about another body that wasn't really counted in the body count in the original 1946 murders, where there was a guy that was found run over by a train, but, you know, when you took a close look at him, you know, he was like...
Mm-hmm.
Stabbed as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think cuts a quick shot with like cleanly
diced on the rails.
Diced in like six different pieces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, to use a Chris Wilsonism, he is the expedition dump, isn't he, this guy?
Mm-hmm. He is, yeah. Definitely for sure, because he introduces another suspect in that there was a guy called Hank McCready.
Yeah, strong name.
Yeah,
good name. That yeah.
It was killed at the same time as Benjamin Sill was taken into custody a few years later, and apparently he vowed to on his deathbed. I'm right thinking he has a son, and he vowed on his deathbed to avenge his death.
Yes, kids down the generational line have been bred to hate the town or something.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So it's going back to this idea that Jamie sort of had about Benjamin Sill and his son, but it's actually someone else instead who hasn't previously been really documented.
Yeah.
Mr. Pierce, I've read everything there is to read on this. I've never even heard of this Hank McCready.
It should have been front page news, but while the Arkansas police were finding McCready, the Texas police, they're arresting Sewell, and so you got two different camps, each saying they got the phantom. And what neither of them's piecing together is that Sewell was in custody when McCready was killed, proving that neither one was a phantom.
So Sewell was in jail. And then did anything ever come from McCready?
Oh, he's dead. Yep, and dead men don't complain much, but his pregnant wife, Mary, she's pissed as shit.
Her name is Mary?
My daddy tracked her down in 1974, and oh, she was still bitter. She said the Texarkana had done worse than killed her husband. It had shat on his memory, and in the process, it was shitting on her life. It was shitting on her son's life.
Who? You think is a phantom?
No!
Exactly, so we get the dump of information. And then they sort of piss off again, and he stands on his roof having a scotch on a fag or whatever it is he's doing. And then we go back to our lass's house, who basically has a wee bit of a rummage with her new bloke, doesn't she? He successfully rummages.
I can't believe he got there.
I know, yeah.
Honestly.
Now,
it's just kids these days, they put no effort in and they get over the awards.
Yeah.
Just wore bloody it down, millennials.
Wore it down, yeah. Now, post-rummage, he's asleep and there's a really nice little almost dream sequence thing going on.
Yeah, yeah.
With a original rummager.
Yep.
Really on in the film. What did you think of that?
It was very nicely done. I mean, yeah. It got obvious pretty quickly that it wasn't real, but
yeah.
I really like the imagery.
Yeah, no, totally.
Because, like, you know, I'm right thinking, like, a house and such that starts breaking away and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a film that, as I say, on the face of it, this is like meat and two veg slash a remake territory.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Actually, when you watch it, it's quite daring in the things that it does. Like, yeah. There's absolutely no, you know, if it was just another lazy slasher film, you know, there would be no thought of doing a sequence like this or doing those really nice intercut bits between the 40s and the present day. You know, there is a real effort to sort of elevate this above.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say it does make quite a good effort. I mean, I've got a couple of comparisons later on, which doesn't make it a completely cutting edge idea.
Yeah.
But yeah, they could have just gone ahead and made a straight up remake or a sequel. But, you know, they try and do things like really well with with intertextuality, back to A level media.
There we go. I was waiting for someone to drop that.
Yeah. Intertextuality.
The Simpsons.
Wanker.
Yeah. Another way of putting it, just referencing the earlier film and, you know, using that as a base.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's all good stuff.
Yeah, so.
And even better, Nick's about to get it.
Well, sort of, yeah. He gets basically clumps, doesn't he, when he sneaks out in a very suspicious sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And off he fucks for a while. And then we have, before we know it, our heroine and her gran are basically packing up and getting ready to leave.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
Can
you blame him at this point, really?
Has Nick been tagged out at this point?
I don't think they've found him. I think he's just been clubbed, hasn't he?
He has been clubbed.
He's
railroaded later on.
Yeah.
I think... it's the sequence with the lawn lights, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's like running away from the house.
Really liked it.
Yeah.
It is good scene.
Because they do that sequence probably about 20 minutes before, where they're just walking along people's lawns, and they're having a conversation, and it's fairly mundane, and you expect something to happen with the use of the lights and stuff, and then the nice policeman, who we should have mentioned at this point, with the mustache, who will be quite important at some point.
He will be, but he's sort of in helping investigation in the background.
He's very innocuous, isn't he?
But he's
always kind of positive and supportive.
Yeah.
He kind of breaks that scene up, but when Nick does get taken out from behind, the payoff with the light trick is finally there.
Yeah.
And when the lights finally come back on, because they're all on sensors.
Yeah.
So as he's moving towards the screen, the lights behind him go out.
Yeah.
But obviously one comes back on with Baghead in it.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff.
Yeah. No, it was nicely done. Really nicely done that. And yeah, as I say, after that, it's the next day. And her and her grand decide they're off. I think something might happen to stop them leaving, you know.
You think so, yeah?
Nah, they're just going to leave. The end. Finn.
Done.
Shit and popcorn.
Oh dear, we don't know who the murderer is here either.
Who done it?
So
find out again in the remake in 2047.
Yeah.
Set in 2013.
So we get next, they stop off at the petrol station, don't they? And this is one of my favourite scenes in the film.
Mm. Oh, a cliche moment of the week just pops up.
Ding ding.
Something happening at a petrol station.
It
never goes off without incident.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah. If there's either a robbery, a shooting, or the whole fucking thing explodes.
Yeah. Or your card gets rejected and you can't pay for your fuel. Don't know what's worse. So she pops into the shop to get some bits and bobs. Grant's fueling up outside.
Yep.
And she gets JFK'd, basically.
Yeah.
Didn't she?
Pretty fucking nasty.
Right in the neck.
Right in the neck. Fucking very well executed this.
Yes, mate, lovely.
Now, we've got something quite unusual going on with this killer in a slasher film now.
Because
what we're dealing with here is a multiple weapon killer.
Well, there's no established MO.
Yeah.
He's killing efficiently.
Yeah.
And what the context dictates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's adapting to his opportunities.
Yeah.
Very interestingly done.
Although the trumpet thing was a bit lavish, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But he did adapt because the guy had a trumpet in the trunk.
Yeah. He did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a bit overblown.
We've already had this crescendo of puns, mate.
Fair one. There's something really interesting, and I don't think it's been fully explored in horror films, really, of the dread of being under the gaze of a sniper.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I think they do it quite well in this little sequence.
Yeah, he clearly has the upper hand. He's on elevated territory for the last couple of kills.
Yeah.
Sort of thing, and he's always had the advantage. And here, especially, like we were saying with Alien 3 in the last episode, as soon as you introduce, like, an automatic weapon into the picture, suddenly everything is very dangerous.
Absolutely.
And there's not really... I think there's been a couple of gunshots in this film so far with a silenced weapon.
Yeah.
But this elevates it to the point where he's just... Obviously, it's not populated because it's late at night, but he's in a public area.
Yeah.
Mm. In a building. Just fucking firing off a rifle.
Yeah, isn't there another dude in the petrol station that gets tagged out as well?
He gets fucked up as well, yeah.
Yeah, that's the first one that gets discovered before.
He's caught in the crossfire.
Yeah.
It's all quite good stuff, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And then after that, well, because she's under a threat of a sniper, she runs away and goes into, I think it's like a bus station, train station sort of.
Depot place. Sort of looking thing.
Yeah. And there's a chase around and a bit of a nice call back in that she's hiding. And then she gets another phone call from him. Basically, like, declares where she is.
Yeah.
Which manages to get out of there.
It was interesting that he had her number.
Very
good.
Yeah, if I'd say we'll go on the twist in a minute, but that is a very nice detail in the grand scheme of things, you know.
Yeah.
But it isn't just an act of randomness.
So she runs off, doesn't she?
Yeah, to a riverbank sort of thing.
Is this where does she run across the rail line and find Matey Boy?
Oh yes, yeah, I'll say yeah.
He's gone to pieces, hasn't he?
He has, yeah.
Hey.
Yeah. His career in archiving was derailed, motherfucker.
It was, yeah.
Can you imagine if they try to do that in this country? Like, it's time to railroad tracks, like, oh, it's been fucking delayed again.
Oh, no, yeah. So lightning at the box, there's some rain or something, there's a goat on the track.
There's a settee on there.
Yeah. There's a drunk Macam on the train that's kind of stopped it off in Scunthorpe. Yeah. Not going to be here.
And by the time a train arrives, then the victim's already died of old age.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. The next scene. The next little bit is she's running, and our lad's arsenal is expanded to a crossbow.
Absolutely, mate.
What if Robin Hood did it?
Yeah, could be. The dark ears. Fucking brutal looking bow and arrow shot through the leg.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Picked that up from Blue Moon.
Yeah.
She took an arrow to the knee.
Ouch. And then we get Swerve 1. There's DOS of them. That's Spanish for two.
Yes, mate. Just like Blade DOS.
Yeah. Exactly like that. Yeah.
And this is played quite nice because she's quite delirious at the time from the pain.
Is she seeing double R?
But then it anchors it quite nicely when she turns from left to right and they flip 180 on the camera rules and it's like, oh no, that's two of them. Two mandems.
Yeah.
Yep.
So
it's a double bagger, mate.
This is double bagger. It's a double bagger.
And who is it? Well, one of them is her dead boyfriend.
Yeah.
So I finally caught his name's Corey. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course it is.
One. So that's Swerve. And the other one is MacReady's grandson.
Mustache cop.
Yeah.
Oh, aye.
Now, the first time I watched this, and I don't know what happened to you guys on this one, fucking got me that, sucking me right in.
Yeah, the cop Swerve got me.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, the kid Swerve got me. Didn't think about it.
It kind of got me, but I was like, You are going to have to say at least two really fucking good lines of exposition to put that boy there.
Yeah.
I'm going to need something good for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cop, I can accept. That was a brilliant swerve. That's how he got the number. That makes sense. That's how he knew where she was all the time. Yeah. Brilliant. That's how he's got weapons training. Oh, sick.
Yeah.
Of course.
Good swerve, though, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It was, yeah.
And obviously, with the guy in prison, he had a visitor once a day. But obviously the cop could see him as many times as he wanted.
Yeah.
And he said he'd been on the force 20 years at one point as well.
Yeah,
that's right. Very clever.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Mm. I thought it was cleverly done stuff.
Nice.
It was, yeah.
And then they do... sorry, Wilson, go on. You.
No, Wilson.
No, I was just going to say then we're going to, like, try and frame her for the other murders.
Yep.
Because you know, gonna believe it's a dead boyfriend, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's bullshit. Yeah.
They do basically, they copy the exact ending of Scream 2 here.
That's gonna be one comparison, Sam.
Yeah. Sorry, Russell.
In fact, quite funny, I've got like, well, three films actually, like, of what this borrows from. Scream 1, Scream 2, and Scream 4.
Yeah. No, fair.
But we'll get into that further in a moment. But so yeah, we got a framer, but she manages to shoot him. Well,
bit of an aggressive rummage going on, isn't there?
It was.
Well, he tags out the ex-boyfriend bloke, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Oh, he just pops him.
Just pops him. Yeah.
Savage
yeah.
that.
Yeah, yeah. Just out of nowhere. He does talk too much, though. To be fair.
Yeah.
Well, fuck that! I wanted to be a part of something special. I wanted to be remembered like the Phantom. When people talk about what happened in Texarkana, about how the Phantom came back, oh, I'll know that I made that happen!
Ah! They're gonna keep looking for you. They're gonna keep looking for
the Jamie. Why would they?
No.
But I'd tell them. That I caught the two kids who did it. Who were so obsessed with the Phantom that one faked his own death. She killed her own grandma.
No,
and you know what?
He's a bit of a dick. And he's called Corey.
He'd be the one to fuck it up if they did kill her.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he sort of floats in the river, and that's sort of it, isn't it?
Yep. How does Matey Boy die? How does Mustache Cop die?
She tags him, doesn't she?
Yeah, but
shoots him.
Yeah, but they both get shot.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Then he falls into the river and his body's never found.
Yeah.
Ooh.
There's a sort of the classic slasher sequence at the end where she goes off to uni and it's happy days. Yeah. And there's the voiceover about, you know, you never know, bad shit happens to everyone, blah blah blah. And then there's just like a shadow behind her.
Yeah. And suddenly the shadow. Yeah. The end.
And that was the, in my opinion, highly unexpectedly quite good meta sequel to The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah, it is good.
Even though The Town didn't really dread Sundown that much this time.
No.
Not really, no.
The time I was ambivalent to Sundown.
Yeah. Now, be honest, lads. Was you expecting that when I picked it?
Well, when you said about a meta sequel, sort of did, yeah, if I'm being honest. But,
right.
To be fair, I didn't expect it to be as decent as it was.
Yeah. I expected the original to be an instant classic that I would fall in love with.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah.
And I expected the remake to be a cheap cash-in on that sort of thing from that sort of era.
Yeah.
But I like them the opposite way around.
I do.
Yeah.
It was quite a weird thing, because I've heard the name so many times that I thought, oh, this must just be an ultimate classic I've never seen.
Yeah, I think the remake brings back an original to reverence that doesn't necessarily deserve to be there.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Basically. So, what are your final thoughts then, Dave? What do you reckon, all in all?
I'm really sold on it, to be honest.
Right.
As you know, if the film's not going to blow me away and reinvent the wheel, I do appreciate efficiency.
Yeah.
Let's just fucking crack on and make our box office money.
Yeah.
And I value that in a film like this. I thought it was really slick to the point. There was a lot of, like I said, there's a lot of experience behind the camera, and that really shows on screen.
Yeah.
It's very well oiled, very well done. Intro sequence 1-er has kind of stuck with me.
It's really nicely done.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know when you see old Kurosawa stuff and you see him just do a tracking shot and he reframes stuff following a character and they move back, move around. It was just, it had such a lovely sort of callback to classic cinema in it.
Yeah. Mm. I would recommend, if you're ever, you know, working and looking for something to listen to, listen back to the soundtrack.
Okay.
It's actually very, and it's very 70s horror inspired.
Okay. I'll probably remember it as soon as I put it on.
Yeah, you will.
Yeah. I remember appreciating it at the time.
Yeah. It didn't offend you, which is, you know.
Not at all. No. I like most things, but yeah.
Yeah.
The fact I didn't notice it is probably a credit to how much I was enjoying the film and how much it was helping everything along, which is good.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Mm. Willie?
No, it was good fun.
No. It was a lot better than what I expected it to be. The meta stuff was decent. To be honest, in a sort of like a post-Scream world, as it were, it's not as clever as it would have been, and maybe if this film had come out in like 1990 or something like that. Yeah. So it's a bit behind on that, but I do like how it uses the original to anchor, you know, anchor itself to make quite a vastly superior film.
Yeah.
So are we agreed that because it is a meta sequel to the original, it is better than it would have been as a standalone piece? Or would it have just blended into the background if it wasn't that?
I think if it didn't have the meta aspects, it would have been too generic from... They would have had to do something else, because otherwise the concept would have been just too generic and... to do anything with it, you know, you need a hook in there, and it can't just be, oh, it's a bit like Halloween, isn't it? These days, especially like a slash film, has got to be something else within that concept. Than guy just stabs people, the end.
Yeah. What about you, Rob?
It was very surprisingly enjoyable experience, and I think there's actually a lot more of thought that's gone into it than immediately strikes the eye.
Had you seen both, or had you just seen the remake?
I'd just seen the remake prior to this.
Okay, yeah.
I'd seen bits of the first one, but I've not seen it all the way through. I think that, as I said at the start, I do think that the experience is heightened by watching the original. I think that the... It's a very interesting approach that's been taken with it. And I think there are possibly, we'll find out down the line, but perhaps there'll be some comparisons to be made between this and the upcoming Halloween film. We shall see.
Yes.
I think it's an interesting avenue that could be explored. I guess there's only one thing left to do, really, lads.
Get your shovel, Willie.
Shoveling. Shovel it all.
Third rating, I'd give a 2 because you know, there's nothing really to note here. I don't think I've got no issues with the film at all. So, bit of a weird one. Popcorn, I'll give a 7. You know, I really enjoyed it. You know, it definitely exceeded expectations. Like I said, it's just a shame that this film wasn't released like about a decade or two ago, because I think it could have been pretty groundbreaking at the time in the way that, you know, like Scream would become, you know, for using like horror tropes and like I'm playing about with you know, with that with the genre itself. But so it's a bit of a loss also run in that respect, but it does very well.
And you,
Dave Walker?
Shit rating, I'm gonna go for 3.
Okay,
My only gripe with it is that the expedition dumps when they come are fucking heavy.
Yes, especially on that fucking boat.
Yeah. They're fast and they're quite riveting at times.
Yeah.
Boat rivet.
Very odd.
You're sailing away these puns today.
I think I fucking sank it, mate, to be honest.
You really anchored that one in.
Yup, shit creek right paddle.
Popcorns.
I was going to say the other one was the fact that the lone wolf character, who's still called Lone Wolf in this, played by a black guy. I don't know whether that's meant to be funny or not. that they've got a cigar-chomping white guy and the oil baron-looking dude in the original.
Yeah, they do, yeah.
And they've got a black cowboy-looking dude in this one. He just fucking disappears.
Yeah, he does, yeah. He does just adds nothing.
Yeah, and the only point when he comes back is when he's watching a TV in the third act and goes, oh, that's terrible. And then it's over.
Yeah.
That's literally it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to go for a 3 because otherwise it's completely enjoyable. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. There's nothing I can really pick at. That's me being picky. Popcorns, 7.
Yeah, fair. Yeah,
thoroughly enjoyable.
Fair.
Roberto.
I'm going to concur with you on the shit and go for 3.
Yep.
You know, I think it's... At absolute worst,
mm-hmm.
it is a very, very workmanlike, quite enjoyable experience.
Mm-hmm.
Popcorn-wise... I'm going to throw an extra kernel of popcorn on this solely for the severed head being used to smash a window.
Oh, fuck yeah.
So I'm going to go with an 8.
Ooh. Nice. Solid. We're all agreed pretty much there, aren't we?
We have, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm very, very pleased that you both enjoyed it because I was hoping that you would.
Didn't enjoy the original, though.
No, but you know, you have pulled to it suffer back. Before you gain sometimes.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the town that's ready to sundown.
It was.
And you are in the chair next.
I'm in a big boy's chair next,
big
mate.
Big boy chair next.
Yes, mate. And obviously, my big boy's chair is bigger than yours because size does matter, Rob.
As Kevin Nash taught us in TNA, yeah. Get the wrestling reference in. Yeah.
Put it just in there, just in time.
Thank you.
Weaseled it in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, dear, like a splinter.
Yeah.
It is 1998's disaster piece on many levels. Godzilla.
Oh!
Nice.
Yes.
Bit of Jamiroquai.
Bit of Jamiroquai, with an ad campaign that promised so much,
delivered so little,
and a third act that was just oh,
it was
love Jurassic Park, mate.
Yeah.
We're gonna. It's the essentially a remake of the 1954 Japanese monster movie.
Yeah,
which if you're Japanese, I'm assured is a fucking horror film.
Well, yeah, and nearly a fucking documentary, mate.
Yeah,
in
yeah.
a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Godzilla's a horror film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The original one.
Yeah.
A lot
more than Mummy Returns, anyway.
Well, this is the same kind of thing, Willie.
Same scenario, isn't it?
It's a remake / sequel to something that was a horror, and they've made it not a horror.
Yeah.
They've just got old Jewish men being Jewish.
Yeah.
Ooh, I'm a cab driver. Ooh, transition to the next scene with a tube train. It's set in New York.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Job done.
Excellent. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles don't turn up, though.
Fucking looking forward to it.
Excellent.
Well, I guess it's time for me to say goodbye for the week. So it's goodbye from Dave Walker.
Aww.
It's goodbye from me, goodbye. And it's a goodbye from Chris Wilson.
Was that your bye?
It was, yes.
Cool.
That was a bit
disappointing. Bye! There he is. Don't let him go last. Don't give him the satisfaction.
I know, it's his gimmick, isn't it?
He goes home and wanks to this.
I know, well, he needs something.
Bye!
He needs this.
Don't forget, you can follow us and keep up with all our updates. Regular updates, possibly, maybe, hopefully, if Wilson gets his arse in gear. At Cinemortuary on Twitter, / Cinemortuary on Facebook. And of course, at Cinemortuary on Instagram. I don't know how you do pictures of podcasts, but we're going to do that anyway.